From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Climate change is happening. Temperatures on Earth are rising. June 2014 was the warmest June ever recorded. We've got extreme heat, drought, wildfire. A new book of harrowing climate science fiction rolls all those facts forward to the year 2393, when a surviving Chinese historian is coolly looking back on how we dithered and died in climate change. It's a slap across the face from the future, this hour On Point, looking back on us and the mess to come from climate change. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Will we be seen as the fools who denied and dithered as the planet tipped? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Naomi Oreskes. She's a professor of the history of science at Harvard University, co-author with Eric Conway of Caltech of the new novel called The Collapse of Western Civilization. She also co-wrote with Eric Conway Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. You can read an excerpt from this incredible little new book at our website, onpointradio.org. Naomi Oreskes, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I don't know if I've ever read a 50-page book that packed quite this much dynamite. It's short, but it just goes deep. Introduce us to your conceit. I began to there, but who is it who's doing what in this book, fictionally?
The narrator is the president of the Second People's Republic of China Academy of Sciences in the year 2393. The occasion is the 300th anniversary of the collapse of Western civilization, and a group of scholars have gathered to discuss the causes of the collapse. And this essay is her lecture explaining the work that she and her colleagues have done to try to answer the question, how is it possible that those people knew so much about what was happening to them and yet did so little to prevent it?
It's the kind of exercise that we're very accustomed to doing on the Romans or the Minoans or any number of ancient civilizations. You take this up from a kind of future perspective on us. I just found it incredibly affecting, partly because you do not fear to walk where a lot of scientists don't want to walk. You describe in graphic detail what happens, at least in one hypothetical future, in this century. And it's not pretty.
Exactly. So one of the reasons Eric Conway and I wrote this book was because we had spent years, literally years, reading thousands and thousands of pages of scientific research on climate change and what its likely implications would be. And yet, as we lectured across the country, Eric and I both gave many, many lectures all across the United States and elsewhere after we published Merchants of Doubt, we came to realize that most people really didn't understand why climate change really mattered. They saw it as something that was far away in the future, something that would affect people who were far away, like in Bangladesh, or something that was just about polar bears. One of my colleagues, a smart, educated person, once said to me, Naomi, explain to me why I should be worried about polar bears. And I thought, wow, if people think that this is just about polar bears, then the scientific community has really not communicated what's at stake.
I want you to read from us, from the book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, it's called. As Naomi says, that doesn't happen until 2093 in this sci-fi or cli-fi, climate science fiction, another kind of term out there these days, telling. But well before that, and well within the lifetime of many, 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 many of our listeners right now, things go terribly bad. I wish you'd read, we're getting into 2040 here. That's not even 30 years from now in your telling. Could you read for us?
Sure. Thank you. By 2040, heat waves and droughts were the norm. Control measures such as water and food rationing and Malthusian one-child policies were widely implemented. In wealthy countries, the most hurricane and tornado-prone regions were gradually but steadily depopulated, putting increased social pressure on areas less subject to those hazards. In poor nations, conditions were predictably worse. Rural portions of Africa and Asia began experiencing significant depopulation from out-migration, malnutrition-induced disease and infertility, and starvation. Still, sea level rise had only risen 9 to 15 centimeters around the globe, and coastal populations were mainly intact. Then, in the Northern Hemisphere summer of 2041, unprecedented heat waves scorched the planet, destroying food crops around the globe. Panic ensued, with food riots in virtually every major city. Mass migration of undernourished and dehydrated individuals, coupled with explosive increases in insect populations, led to widespread outbreaks of typhus, cholera, dengue fever, yellow fever, and viral and retroviral agents never before seen. Surging insect populations destroyed huge swaths of forests in Canada, Indonesia, and Brazil. As social order began to break down in the 2050s, governments were overthrown, particularly in Africa, but also in many parts of Asia and Europe, further decreasing social capacity to deal with increasingly desperate populations. As the great North American desert surged north and east, consuming the high plains and destroying some of the world's most productive farmland, the U.S. government declared martial law to prevent food riots and looting. A few years later, the United States announced plans with Canada for the two nations to begin negotiations towards the creation of the United States of North America to develop an orderly plan for resource sharing and northward population relocation. The European Union announced similar plans for voluntary northward relocation of eligible citizens from its southernmost regions to Scandinavia and the United Kingdom.
Naomi Oreskes reading there from her new book with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Naomi, you read that so coolly, maybe in the voice of a Chinese historian, as you put it in your conceit here, in the year 2393, looking back. But what you're describing there is a kind of hell on earth.
Well, that's right. And I think what we wanted our readers to feel, not just to read and not just to hear, but to actually feel what the significance of this would be. And Eric Conway and I have talked about this a lot, that one of the challenges that scientists have, one of the reasons why scientists are hamstrung in talking about their work, is science isn't supposed to be about feeling. It's supposed to be about rational, intellectual thought. And yet we can't really understand why climate change matters if we don't understand what's at stake politically, economically, and emotionally. And so the idea of writing in a fictional voice of a future historian was in a way to be dispassionate, because the future historian is trying to analyze what happened, but also to convey in an emotionally compelling way what is really at stake here.
When we think about this future, I think not many of us go to this. I mean, what you describe here, this Chinese historian looking back, is a tremendous, tremendous amount of disruption and just plain deep suffering. You're talking about mass forced migrations, essentially, forced by climate change, by rising seas, by fire and flood and drought and starvation and disease and surging insect populations. People having to leave coastlines, having to leave what, the Southwest United States. I guess the U.S. merges with Canada because so much of our own territory has become nearly uninhabitable.
Yes, exactly. So in a way, what it's really about, if you had to boil down why climate change matters to a single word, the word would be suffering. People will suffer if we don't take prompt action to do something about this issue. And I don't think most people have really got that idea. I think a lot of people have an image of climate change as a sort of inconvenience. Oh, yeah, it'll be a little hotter in summer. You'll turn up the air conditioning. Maybe there'll be some more intense storms and maybe some trees will fall on people's houses and there'll be some insurance claims. You know, it's all still in the category of inconvenience. But this isn't an inconvenience. If sea level rises a meter or more, which many scientists believe it will by the end of the century, that's not just an inconvenience. That starts to be a reconfiguration of social and political institutions.
And what you point out is that at a certain point, that is not orderly at all. That order breaks down. I mean, to the point that you described the collapse of Western civilization. But at a certain point, governments just can't deal with all this.
Exactly. And that is probably the most important thing that Eric and I wanted to convey in this book. So this book really came out of our previous work on Merchants of Doubt, where we researched in quite great detail who the people were who were challenging the scientific evidence of climate change and why they were rejecting well-established, peer-reviewed scientific evidence. And what we found was that in most cases, it was ideologically driven. that climate change skeptics, contrarians, and deniers were afraid that climate change would be used as an excuse for government intervention in the marketplace and an excuse to take control of our lives. And Eric and I thought there was a profound irony in that story, because if we don't do something about climate change, that's going to become the biggest excuse of all. So think about it for a moment. When do we accept the necessity of the federal government usurping local authority? When there's a natural disaster, when there's a hurricane or a tornado or flood.
And at that point, they get tremendous authority. Leave your home. Leave this town.
Exactly. That's when they basically individual liberty goes out the window mm-hmm. and the government tells us what to do. One of the clearest, most, I would say, practically certain consequences of climate change is that there will be more natural disasters, more hurricanes, more floods, more wildfires. So if you're worried about government overreach, if you're worried about the growth of big government, you should be doing everything in your power to help support action now to prevent the sort of worst case scenario that we outline in our story.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Terror there in the day after tomorrow when a tsunami hits New York City. In the new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, my guest Naomi Oreskes and her co-writer Eric Conway take it even further. Maybe sort of in the road mode from Cormac McCarthy's book and 2009 movie.
Each day is more gray than the one before. It is cold. And growing colder as the world slowly dies. No animals have survived, and all the crops are long gone. Soon all the trees in the world will fall.
We're looking this hour at a science fiction look back on the climate change facts of our time and what's to come on climate change denial and destruction, observed by a surviving Chinese historian in the year 2393, looking at how we got it so wrong, how we waited too long, how we suffered in this sci-fi, cli-fi look at us and our future. It's called The Collapse of Western Civilization. Naomi Oreskes is with me in the studio. You can join us. What do you think? Naomi, you talked about how liberty is the thing people fear giving up when it comes to addressing climate change. That's not a hypothetical fear. Here's Rush Limbaugh.
The government lies about something. Scientists lie about something. People panic. Oh, my God, my children. Oh, my God, we're going to boy. Yeah, unless the government does something. And then the government comes up with ideas to fix it. And what they involve? You giving up freedom. You paying higher energy prices. You driving smaller cars. You dialing back your lifestyle. That's the solution.
Fine. Have your fear, says Naomi Oreskes to Rush Limbaugh. But if something isn't done, the loss of liberty could be far, far worse, all the way to the collapse of Western civilization. We painted a little bit of this picture that you described by 2040, 2041, of seas rising all over the place, kind of hellish climate, insects all over the place, Americans migrating, everybody migrating away from the coasts, the Western Antarctic ice shelf collapsing, Greenland collapsing, Americans trying to head north into Canada, merging with them. Take it on from there toward this 2093 actual collapse of Western civilization. Let us hear how you tell it.
One of the things that I do when I talk to scientists is I sometimes ask them, well, what do you worry about the most? What do you lie awake at night worrying about? And almost to a person, scientists say one of two things. They either say they're really worried about all of the carbon that's frozen into the Arctic and the Arctic permafrost, that could start melting and lead to much greater climate change. And they worry about the West Antarctic ice sheet, which we know is beginning to become destabilized. And could lead to not just centimeters of sea level rise, but meters. So in other words, tens of feet of sea level rise. And if that were to happen, then we're not looking at the world as we know it. And Rush Limbaugh's worry about driving a smaller car will be the
changing
least.
Changing your lifestyle.
That will be the least of a small car.
Changing your address. You'll be lucky to be alive. Lucky for your kids and grandkids to be alive.
Yes, yes. You'll be very happy if you could drive a small car.
Keep it graphic for us. You do
keep
in the
graphic
book. Help us understand your imagined path ahead.
Well, one of the things we do in the book is we have maps. We took the scientific data, and this is an important thing I hope the readers will take away. even though the book is a work of fiction, even though the work is imaginative, it's all based on facts. Everything that happens in the story is based on scientific projections published in peer-reviewed literature.
Tell us what happens in the story.
So what happens is sea level rises, the West Antarctic breaks up, Greenland melts, and we get meters of sea level rise, which causes large areas of the globe to be drowned. So areas like the south of Florida, Key West, areas like a big part of the Texas.
And way north of Key West.
You've way got, north, right. Or the way up
to Naples, Tampa, Fort Myers gone. Miami gone. I mean,
right.
Orlando's
the whole southern
kind of
half.
There.
Right. No more Disneyland. The whole southern half of Florida is inundated. Similarly, large sections of the Texas Gulf Coast, all of the Netherlands. Hundreds of millions of people are displaced from Bangladesh.
This we've heard before, but what you describe is what it means for the humans living through this, and not so long from now.
Exactly. So imagine now, I mean, take this seriously. Imagine if Miami is inundated. Where do those people go? How do we deal with it? Think about what happened in Hurricane Katrina, but now magnify that 10 or 100 or
cities
even 1,000
times. Cities all over the
place,
all over the world.
Right. Imagine we all know what a catastrophe Hurricane Katrina was, both for the people who experienced it and for the country as a whole. Now imagine if that happened simultaneously all over coastal United States.
And that's just the U.S. You described something like, if I remember correctly, 20% of the world's population on the move.
Exactly. And of course, it's hard to know
and
for
not
sure.
In an orderly way, not catching regularly scheduled flights and trains, but sort of desperately by any means.
Exactly. And that's one of the most important points. An orderly migration where people decide to move because they want to is one thing. A disorderly migration where hundreds of millions of people are dislocated and many of those people are hungry, many of those people are sick, many of those people are angry. That's a very unpleasant thought to take seriously.
Now this gets to, we'll come to it, the end of Western civilization. We do note it's a Chinese historian telling the story about our demise. We'll come to that. There's a point in the story in the last half of this century where people just, they can't take it anymore. They decide we've got to take active engineering efforts to try and turn this around. And they begin to do that. What do?
They try to engineer the climate by injecting sulfate aerosols, particles of dust, into the atmosphere in order to block the sun and cool the earth.
How's that work out?
Not very well.
Why?
Well, at first it starts to work. It looks like it's going well. But then there's this effect, which scientists have in fact predicted, which is the breakdown of the Indian monsoon. And when that happens, you get massive crop loss in India.
The monsoon's already not very good this year.
Correct. And that may, in fact, already be related to climate change. So what we're trying to show is the way in which these things ramify.
So they stop sending the aerosol sulfate particles into the air.
Which leads to even more climate change, what's known as the rebound effect. So then things get dramatically worse very quickly. And then this leads to further dislocation, food riots, and the like.
What do you mean by 2093? Again, well within the lifetime of anybody born this morning, today, by the end of Western civilization?
Well, sometimes people talk about climate change and they say, oh, we're all going to go extinct or we have to save the planet. And neither of those views is really right. Humanity is not going to go extinct. And the planet, of course, will continue for billions more years. The issue is what happens to us, what happens to people living at that time. And so based on scientific estimates of sea level rise and how many people live within 1 to 5 or 1 to 6 meters of sea level, we thought it was a plausible estimate, actually not an exaggeration, to say that 20% of the world's population could be affected. Now, that might not seem like a lot at first. 80% of us are okay. But if you do the arithmetic,
that's billions,
it's billions of people, right? It's almost a billion people. Mm. Right. That's a heck of a lot of people to die.
Or be sent on the road shoeless and desperate.
Exactly.
But the end of civilization, what does that mean? People are still thinking, well, okay, people are moving around, so they're moving to Chicago. What's the big deal?
So it's the collapse of Western civilization, mm-hmm. because the argument we make in the book is when all of this happens, when things start to really run amok, who's going to be best equipped to deal with it? And it's not going to be the friends of Rush Limbaugh. It's going to be the authoritarian countries of the world, like China, that have centralized governments that have the capacity to step in and order their people to move.
And they do. In your telling, China just starts to build new cities in the interior of China and orders people to go there, and they do.
And they do. And one of the things we've already seen in China is that the Chinese have developed an incredible capacity to build buildings in very, very short amounts of time, much, much faster than we do here in the United States or in Europe.
While they're doing that, what's happening in North America that leads to the end of Western civilization?
Well, the book leaves a lot of things.
Chaos and marauding and
right.
Government breaking down and martial law.
Right. The idea is that social order effectively breaks down in the West. And so it's the Chinese civilization that essentially becomes, they're the survivors. They're the ones who are left standing.
They hang together.
They hang
culturally.
Together when we don't
fall apart. And now, in your telling, hundreds of years later, they're looking back on that and trying to figure out what it was about us and our democracy that led to denial and ultimately to catastrophe. Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway at Caltech are co-authors of The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. You get the view. Let's go to our listeners. James in Dallas, Texas. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just kind of wanted to point out, as a sci-fi fan, I am a big fan of these kind of things. I like it. They're entertaining, and I don't want to insult what she's doing as an author by any means. I'm sure it's a great work, and I'm actually kind of interested to read it myself. But I think we run into a problem when this is presented as, I guess, a documentary of sorts, except obviously in the future sense. And to clarify, I'm not denying climate change is happening. I'm not denying it is definitely our fault as humans. But, and it's something to be worried about, but I feel like things like this cause people who doubt climate change to only doubt it further, and it caused people who believe in it to almost accept it as fact. And it's just important to remember it is fictionalized, it is exaggerated, because it is trying to entertain, not necessarily primarily inform. And when you, I guess, kind of have these over-fictionalized stories of cli-fi, if you will, it just causes people on one side to accept it and the others to go, oh, well, there's no way that's happening. That's actually what it is, and they just doubt it further.
James, I think we've got your point, and I just want to respond in this way. I'll give it to Naomi, but I should point out, first of all, this is nothing like your regular pulp kind of fiction sci-fi book. It's incredibly short. It's only 50 pages. It's actually quite dense with science, because this imagined Chinese historian is looking back on what was known, and the record is quite abundant on that. It's a very scientific book. Yes, there's conjecture about what may happen, but a lot of it is projection off of what we already know. But it's not going for cheap thrills, I would say, having read it and been just sort of fixated on it since I read this little book. Nevertheless, the point stands, Naomi. James says, look, you may just drive people into their corners or drive them into despair here.
Yeah, James, you're absolutely right. And I'm glad you've raised this point, because it's something that Eric Conway and I, of course, have thought about. And, as a writer, you never know exactly how people will receive your work. You just write what you feel is what you need to write. But I do want to say two things. First of all, it is a work of fiction, but it's not exaggerated. Absolutely everything that happens in the book is based on scientific data and projections. Now, you can argue whether those projections are right or wrong, but this is a work of fiction, but it has footnotes.
Yeah, it's fiction, but it's not just for thrills. And it is powerfully affecting.
Could I add just one more thing?
Please.
And actually, in a way, the reason we wrote the book was exactly because of what you said, because we were being invited to speak all across the country and around the world, and we were being invited to all kinds of workshops on climate science communication. And all these scientists were wringing their hands about why people didn't understand what they were saying. And so this was an attempt on our part to just try something a little different. It's really a kind of experiment. In France, it's been marketed as an essay, an attempt. So it is an attempt. It may not work, but I do hope you'll read it, and I hope you'll tell your friends about it.
I think it works. It's all the more powerful with its brevity and its kind of understated scientific approach to thinking about the future. A pretty tough future. Caitlin in Somerville, Massachusetts. Caitlin, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Naomi Oreskes.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Professor Oreskes, thank you for your work and congratulations on the book. I have a comment, I guess, opposite to what the previous caller, James from Dallas, had to say just a minute ago. I'm wondering if your book goes far enough. I'm not talking about the projections, the accuracy of the projections or environmental realities, but about leveraging the fears and the emotional response and investment of your readers. I haven't yet read the book, so I'm only speaking from the bit that you read aloud.
What do you mean by you're concerned it doesn't go far enough? In what respect, Caitlin?
Well, first of all, the premise that it's written by a surviving historian in 2393, my first gut response was, oh my goodness, the human race lasts that long?
Okay, we'll pick it up.
I will defend that part. I absolutely, I'm 100% convinced that the human race will continue, but it will not continue in the same way that we live today. So,
and that's putting it mildly. I mean, there is desperate suffering and gargantuan disruption of life, anything like we've known it. And this will, even for the Chinese, after all, they're forced to abandon Shanghai and you name it, everything along the coast and head inland, start over.
Oh, yeah. And they don't come away unscathed. I think what, for me, the most important thing is what Tom said at the beginning of the show when he pointed about the Mayans and the Romans. We know that other civilizations have come and gone, and yet we somehow act as if we are immune. But when those civilizations fell, humans didn't go extinct. The institutional structures, the structures of governments, the economies, those are the things that broke down. People survived. And I think that's the most plausible scenario. And so that's the scenario that the book explores.
Begin to go to what this imagined Chinese historian sees as the flaw in our Western philosophy, our way of looking at life, that she, it's a female historian, comes to think was central to our failure to grapple with this. And it's in part because we somehow imagine a life apart from the Earth. She points out that in the late 20th century, we started something called Earth Day. And she says, how odd that there'd be one day a year that they would think of themselves as related, connected to, dependent upon, part of the Earth.
The historian is a woman because one of the good things that happens in the future is we finally have true gender equity. So as Tom just said,
after men screw up that badly.
Right. Thank you. I left you to say that.
Okay.
And exactly, one of the things that our woman historian thinks about is this whole idea that we have of the environment as being something separate from us, something that we can choose to protect or not, depending upon how we feel about it. And she wants to point out that years from now, people will look back on that and scratch their heads and say, how is it possible that these people who were otherwise so sophisticated and so knowledgeable didn't get that their own prosperity, their own health, their own future depended upon the natural environment?
Somehow you're suggesting that even as we sit here right now, we imagine that we are living the human life that is somehow apart from or immune to the rest of life.
Exactly. And yet we couldn't survive without air. We couldn't survive without clean water. And we can't survive in the life that we have now without an equitable climate. So if the climate begins to change in dramatic ways, our lifestyle will change in dramatic ways as well. And because it's likely to come in disruptive ways, it's likely to come quickly. The idea that we can easily adapt to it, I think, is very unrealistic.
And you make clear that our capacity for adaption will diminish as disruption grows, that we're just, it's like when you're not well, you're not as good at bouncing back, at figuring out what to do.
Exactly. My mother always said, never make an important decision when you're sick. When you're suffering, you lose the capacity to respond and to solve your problems. And so one can easily imagine a kind of downward cycle where order begins to break down, society is challenged, and as society's challenges cause order to break down more, we become less and less able to solve the problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a science fiction look back on the climate change facts of our time and what's to come on climate change denial and destruction observed in this telling by a surviving Chinese historian in the year 2393. The book is, and this is a little stick of dynamite of a book, 50 pages. It will blow your mind. The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future is the title. Its authors are Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. Naomi at Harvard, Eric at Caltech. People in high places still not buying it. This is Republican Senator Marco Rubio. This was in May. ABC's This Week with Jonathan Carl.
You do not think that human activity, the production of CO2, has caused warming to our planet?
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not. And I do not believe that the laws that they propose we pass will do anything about it, except it will destroy our economy.
And so on we go on our merry way. Some of us really in a yahoo fashion. This is a news report from KHOU in Texas. Takes a look at, you may have seen this somewhat, rolling coal. This is trucks, diesel trucks rejiggered to just blow out clouds and clouds of black, dense exhaust called Prius repellent. Some cases acting as a statement against measures to stop climate change.
Big truck lovers are getting new attention for something called rolling coal. Diesel trucks, like fog machines, blanketing other vehicles and even people with black smoke.
For fun, as a kind of screw you to the climate change idea itself. Randy in Gulf Shores, Alabama. Randy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read the book, but I would be curious into more what China, since he was a Chinese philosopher, what China was able to do technologically. Now, I've heard her mention moving away and
yes,
building big cities and such, but technologically speaking, what was China able to do, assuming that they are one of the, if not the chief producer of coal?
Yeah.
Coal energy.
Yes. Randy, I really appreciate your call. Naomi, Randy is listening very closely, and he's right on the money here. You describe how socially and in terms of government they're able to respond better. But lots of people, and I've chatted about this book with some people just in the last 24 hours, saying, wait a minute, China? Isn't China a giant polluter? What about the balance that you're imagining here of social response and technological response, and for that matter, pollution from China?
That's a great question. Thank you for that. So a couple of things. We wanted to focus this book on the social aspects because we felt that the institutional, the cultural, and the economic aspects really weren't getting enough attention. Eric Conway and I have very, very, very long discussions about technology. And honestly, that's what we hope will be our next book. So we want to write a book that really looks closely at the technological questions.
But are you suggesting right here that China is less in denial than the West, than the United States in particular?
Yes, actually, I am suggesting
how so?
That. Well, one of the things we know about China is that while we like to blame China and point out how much their emissions have increased in recent years, the fact is that the average Chinese person still produces only one quarter the greenhouse gas emissions of the average American.
Isn't that just because they're still, for all their growth, still much less economically developed?
Well, in large part, that's true. But it's just important for us to remember that if we say that China has become the world's number one emissions, that's actually not true if you think of it in terms of the amount of emissions that people make, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a billion, more than
we're
a billion
still
people.
The ones one by one belching it out.
Correct. So it's
but
really important.
In toto,
right?
They're belching out a lot.
As a nation, but not as individuals.
Well, that's
right.
A pretty big deal.
Yeah. No, I'm not denying the importance of that. Just want to make sure the facts are straight.
Are you imagining, I know you're going to write more about this in the future, that China somehow gets a technological step ahead
yes.
on the rest of the world,
yes.
on the U.S. in
because,
terms of confronting, dealing with?
Yes, because we know they've actually already done that. One of the things that's going on in China now that hasn't been covered a lot in the Western media is huge investments in renewable energy and also new nuclear capacity. So it is true that China has been continuing to build large numbers of coal-fired power plants, and that's very problematic, and I don't want to diminish how bad that is. But at the same time, they are also investing huge amounts, subsidizing solar development. They have built an entire solar city. So in terms of solar power, I think it's fair to say that they may, in fact, actually be ahead of the United States already.
This book does not see the U.S. on that path with anything like the speed required to fend off a pretty terrible future. All kinds of diseases. A new black plague comes to Europe. Diseases flourish here that we were on top of that we weren't even seeing because, when the body is weak, things come on. When the temperature changes, when there's water everywhere, when it's too hot, when it's too stormy, things happen. People in their hundreds of millions, maybe billions, migrating here in desperation. And we're talking this, he's looking back from 2393, but this is starting in a serious way in 2040, and the book suggests really starting now. We should get into a little bit more of, you spend a lot of time looking at how we pursue science and the Western view of life itself and how those get in the way of us coming to grips with this. You've spoken a little of that, but go more deeply. You go pretty deep on that front.
One of the major issues that our historian analyzes in retrospect is how political ideology contributed to the denial of the reality of climate change. And specifically, it's the ideology of free market capitalism, of laissez-faire capitalism, or what's sometimes referred to as neoliberalism.
The invisible hand.
The invisible
will take care
hand
of everything.
Exactly.
The he invisible sees that, or she sees that, I should say.
Yes, thank you.
From 400 years out as a kind of magical thinking.
Right. Well, we even use the phrase the magic of the marketplace. So we have a kind of magical thinking about the capacity of market capitalism to solve our problems.
What does she decide is the flaw in that? And after all, I mean, this is the Second People's Republic here, right? So, I mean, of should we just – well, of course she doesn't believe in capitalism. She comes out of once communist China.
But she's an academic, okay, and she's studying it as an academic
right
problem.
And what's the flaw she
the
finds?
The flaw is the question of external costs. And this is something that we know about that already has been analyzed and named by economists, that when you burn coal, you pollute the atmosphere. That creates tremendous costs, but those costs are not reflected in the price you paid for that ton of coal. And so we do a lot of damage. Lots of things happen that we don't see reflected in the price in the marketplace. And that failure to account for those external costs is a kind of Achilles heel of capitalism, because it means that all these things we're doing that seem fine maybe actually aren't fine, but we're not getting a signal from the marketplace to tell us that it's not fine.
The science is also way off on the complete picture of CO2 and more going into the air. We discount the leakage from the wellheads. We discount all kinds of things. The bridge, the President Obama talks about these bridge fuels, natural gas and more, very problematic in your telling.
Right. There's also a lot of wishful thinking going on. So I've just written a separate piece that went online yesterday called Wishful Thinking About Natural Gas, which comes out of this story that our historian analyzes. A lot of wishful thinking that we can solve the problem of fossil fuels with more fossil fuels. That's not realistic.
They're cleaner. Natural gas is cleaner than coal.
Well, not if the methane leakage rates from wells are high. And this is the question. There's always these ifs.
Mm-hmm.
Often you can say, just like you can say China's the biggest polluter, well, if you look at it as on a nation state, but not if you look at it on the per capita. So a lot of these things, you need the details. You need the footnotes. And when you look at the footnotes, you actually find that sometimes these things look different and worse than you previously thought.
And through all of this, Westerners in particular somehow seeing themselves as they live their lives as kind of divine or separate from the earth around them anyway in some kind of weird angel elf fashion turns out not to be true. And then as you point out, the idea of liberty itself, people fearing that addressing climate change will mean surrendering liberty to central authority, but in that denial ending up with far less liberty than they might ever have imagined when martial law comes down, even in this country, just to hold things together. Matt in Nashville, Tennessee. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to make two points, I think, that really, I guess, as a society, I think have the most impact on why there's a denial of climate change. I think the first is money. I think that when you see, you know, at least three of the top 10 most profitable companies are oil and fossil fuel energy companies, I think obviously that's a problem.
Mm.
I think secondarily, a lot of the people that are in a position to affect and do a positive move towards reducing some climate emissions won't be alive to see the effects of climate change. I mean, this book's talking 100 years in the future, and even you see the effects maybe 60 years from now. All these people that have the opportunity to do it will either be dead or in a nursing home. So I don't think that they really have a mind of the future. I think that, you know, when we were younger, it was always, you know, protect the world for your kids. But I don't see that same kind of mantra, that same belief anymore.
Matt, just to be very clear, it's only 30 years or less that she's talking about this hitting home in a very, very painful way. So when I hear your voice, I think that means you. I would like to think that it may mean me. Never mind kids or grandkids of listeners right now. It's not quite as far as all that. But money, first of all, and if I can extend that question from Matt in Nashville, you know, do the people with the money escape the very harrowing suffering that you describe here?
The people with the money, we came up with a phrase in the book to try to discuss this issue, and we call it the carbon combustion complex. Matt is absolutely right that a big part of this story is the power of large corporations, the fossil fuel industry that supplies the fossil fuels that are primary drivers of climate change, but also a whole set of other industries that rely on inexpensive energy, like the automobile industry, the highway industry, the aluminum smelting industry. So all of these groups, together with the advertising agencies and PR firms that they work with, have played a very, very large role in trying to persuade us that climate change is not that serious. That leads to the second question about when will it occur? If we think it's far away, then we tend not to think it's serious. And there's lots of social scientific research that shows that. So part of what we were trying to do in the book—
Even if it's our grandkids who are going to be hit, who we say we love.
We say we love, but the reality is we put off, like we don't save enough for our retirements. We save a little, but not enough. So part of what the book is trying to do is to say, this is not as far away as you think. That serious consequences are actually already beginning now.
Yeah.
And by 2040, 2050, 2070, they could be quite serious. Now, one thing, though, I do want to say, I do think you're right, though, that people do tend to discount it. And I wanted to mention something that my good friend Jim Antle, who's the head of the United Church of Christ here in Massachusetts, says. Said, imagine if God's punishment to climate change deniers was that they would have to live for another 100 years.
Tiana in Buffalo. Thanks for calling, Tiana. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. How are you guys doing?
Well.
I just wanted to call in with a quick comment.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get my hands on this book. But I'm a biology student at Duval College here in Buffalo. And as a scientist, a future scientist, I completely understand the argument. I've always believed in global warming. Here in Buffalo, we see it every year. So for me, I think it's hard for people to get behind the idea because they don't necessarily understand the science behind it. And it's hard for politicians to understand because while we do have scientists in Washington, they're not making the laws. And politicians aren't scientists, so they don't understand the science behind it. To them, it's just money. So they don't get the science of, oh, carbon and molecules and elements and all different types of things. So I think for a lot of people to really grasp the concept, they have to understand the science. And once you start talking about the science, they don't want to hear anymore.
Tiana, you're right on it. Politicians get the money. They understand that. They understand emotion. They work that. The science is a different thing. Appreciate your call very much. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
I've been around for a few years, so I've lived during the 60s when nuclear annihilation was considered to be a certainty. And then in the 70s, of course, we had worldwide famine due to overpopulation. Then in the 80s, everybody was tearing their hair out about nuclear winter. So I am a bit skeptical of your guest and her propositions. And my second point is, I'm getting a feeling that this book is as much a political tract as a supposedly scientific tract, and she is very cozy, perhaps, to the idea of a much more authoritarian government whereby academics would have very, very much control and power at the near the seat of
power. Steve, we got it, but what about the argument, and you've heard it here in this hour, that if we don't act now, actually our liberty is going to be much more threatened down the road. If you care about liberty, it sounds like you do. What about that concern?
I'm a little bit concerned about your guest saying that God is going to punish people who deny global warming, because I think this is, when people get that vicious, it means that they have something to hide.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Our time is so short. Forgive me, but I want to give Naomi time to respond.
First of all, I just want to say I'm not vicious at all. And Jim Antle, who I was quoting, is working from love. I've never met a man who's more inspired by what he considers to be God's love for mankind. So this isn't coming from any point of view of viciousness. Secondly, same thing. This is a warning against authoritarian governments. I don't want to see democracy come to an end. I care deeply about democracy, and that's what this book is all about. Third point about the skepticism.
The fear that if we don't get on top of this, circumstances will drive us into systems we don't want to be any part of.
Exactly. So I really hope you will read the book, because that's the argument. It's an argument against authoritarianism. Third point, lots of people raise that. Of course, as a historian, I'm very mindful of the fact that people have been worried about things before. But the fact is we avoided nuclear annihilation because people spoke up and because scientists and politicians work together to create arms control.
You can also create arms control in an afternoon.
Well, I don't know about that. It took a long time.
But you can sign the papers and it's done. This is different, right?
True. But the point is that warnings are part of why people act to prevent catastrophe. We did prevent nuclear annihilation. We did prevent nuclear winter. And it's partly because scientists spoke up, because people spoke up, and because people listened to what the scientists had to tell us about what was at stake. So I see this as being very much analogous with that.
How much of this future that you outline in this short little stick of dynamite of a book do we still have time to avoid?
Well, this is a big question, of course, and we don't really know for sure, because we know that climate change is already underway, that some of the changes are irreversible, and that the climate system is sluggish. So if we begin to take action now to prevent disruptive climate change, we will not see beneficial effects immediately, and that's part of the challenge. But nevertheless, almost every scientist I know believes that if we were to take brisk action now, and the IPCC says this, the National Academy of Sciences say this, this is not a controversial position, that if we took brisk action now to dramatically cut emissions over the next 30 years, we could avoid this disaster scenario.
50 pages, and it will stick in your mind. The book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, co-authors. The View from the Year 2393, of all that was lost, and historian then trying to figure out why we didn't do more when we had a chance. Naomi Oreskes with me in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for the book.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you very much for joining us as well. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.